welcome back to the Spartan History Podcast. This is episode 10, A Storm on the Horizon. Over the next two episodes, I'll be bringing to a close the Bronze Age phase of this podcast. In the introduction to this series, I mentioned that due to the paucity of source material, the Spartan people will be painted against a broader backdrop of Mycenaean history. Just so. To close out that Mycenaean history, it will need to be painted against a broader backdrop of Eastern Mediterranean civilization in order to properly contextualize it. The Late Bronze Age collapse in the region of the Aegean wasn't an isolated incident, nor did it occur in some sort of historical bubble. There are multiple theories as to the reason, but not one explains in full how the area in the general experienced almost universal societal breakdown. Having read extensively on the Bronze Age epoch, I'd like to share with you a hypothesis I've built up over the past few years and on the back of some amazing academic endeavour. My key references are as follows: Rodney Castleton for detailed analysis of the Mycenaean people, Eric Klein for his wisdom on all things Late Bronze Age, Colleen Darnell provides brilliant insight into the superpower of the period, the Egyptians, and finally, Joseph Tainter for his work on the science of system collapse and their aftermath. I encourage anyone looking for a deeper dive at what I'm about to lay out for you to check those scholars out. I think we can look at 1200 BCE as the confluence of doom for the Eastern Mediterranean. Empires that had stood for centuries would crumble in the space of decades, and seemingly overnight when viewed from our distant vantage point. No one factor contributed to their downfall. There would be no silver bullet. I believe the situation was such that these civilizations were buffeted by multiple disasters, natural and man-made, that made repeated recovery difficult and problematic. You'll see, via the evidence presented, how closely connected and interdependent the various kingdoms were, that like dominoes, when one fell, a reaction was started. My supposition is that through a mixture of climate change, mainly drought, and a breakdown in century-old trade routes, the status quo began to destabilize. As the droughts extended, central authority began to break down and cases of internal strife increased. The trade that was so important for maintaining the conspicuous consumption of the ruling elite suffered disruptions. Famine from crop failure increased the strain, and desperate groups of people began to splinter away from their fracturing civilizations and went in search of a better life. This surge of refugees in the region conglomerated and threw itself upon nearby kingdoms, hungry, desperate, and with nothing else to lose. Battles were fought, lands were pillaged, and cities burnt to the ground. With all before destroyed, this mass washed up on the shores of ancient Egypt looking for succor and settlement. They received the sword instead. History had proven already that there could be no peaceful arrangement. Victory would be of little solace for the Egyptians. With their interconnected world shattered, they too would experience a decline. The age of the powerful Bronze Age kingdoms was over, and the Dark Ages were installed. Up until recently, the main antagonists for the strife of this era are an enigmatic group known as the Sea People. It's a problematic modern term and is used to designate a vast and diverse collection of people who invaded Egyptian land twice, once in 1207 and again in 1177 BCE. In fact, out of the nine different names mentioned for who these people were, only three are mentioned as being from the sea. For a long time, they were the scapegoats of the Late Bronze Age collapse. Why is this city burnt in the archaeological record? The Sea People. What happened to the Hittites? The Sea People. Now we consider them to be more of a symptom of the times and not the root cause. If the Bronze Age collapses the cold, they are just the runny nose. So, that's the theory, and I'll break it down over the next two episodes. We're going to start with the Bronze Age economy and its function, then work through some of the big players in the region. Describing them in brief, I really want to focus on the individual cases of societal collapse and analyse the wealth of textual evidence we have from the period. We'll look at possible Sea People activity as we work through the kingdoms and discuss environmental concerns as they come up. I'll be saving the Mycenaeans for next episode, as they are the focus and pivotal to the theories I want to promote. We'll start with the Bronze Age as a general term, which forms the middle classification to modern archaeology's three-age system, that is, the Stone, the Bronze, and the Iron Age, and merely denotes the material most used by cultures and societies for their implements and weapons. It should be noted that there are subdivisions amongst those classifications, and also, whilst almost universal across history, the ages didn't occur at the same time in all places. For example, when we are talking about the Bronze Age in the Aegean region, we refer to the period from roughly 3000 BCE to 1100. However, if this happened to be a show on ancient Nordic practices, our Bronze Age would be more like the period from 1700 through to about 500 BCE. What we are interested in here is what's known as the Late Bronze Age, running from about 1550 BCE through to the era's relative termination around the turn of the 12th century BCE. The star of the show is the alloy which gives the period its name and demarcation, bronze. As an alloy, the material doesn't occur naturally nor by happenstance, requiring the smelting down of copper and tin in a specific ratio to create. Although more readily available, iron ore required temperatures far in excess of what was available at the time, whereas bronze needed heat only slightly greater than the standard campfire. Despite this benefit, the tin component was a rarity in the ancient world. The region sourced this precious metal from three different places: the mountainous regions of Afghanistan, the Spanish Peninsula, and as far afield as Cornwall, England. The acquisition of so rare, yet essential trade goods surely dominated the concerns of Bronze Age rulers and people alike. Like an industrial revolution without coal, a Bronze Age without tin was simply not possible. For the Mycenaeans, the supply of the raw materials for bronze represented a particularly serious concern. The Greek lands have little easily available copper, and no tin at all to speak of. A tight network of trade was essential to supply the needs of the palace temple economy. This lack of natural resources created a country of skilled artisans whose wares were prized across the eastern Mediterranean as a highly valuable trade good. Their pottery, weaponry, and jewellery is found scattered across archaeological sites in the area. Moreover, as it was a time before the advent of coined monies, the law of reciprocity was in place when it came to the exchange of goods. Some of the items traded were perishable, but many of them were not. It's these latter items that turn up in digs throughout the eastern Mediterranean and paint a picture of a world tight in commercial links. Aegean-styled weapons, Egyptian gold artifacts, Cyprian copper, and Canaanite jars are regularly found together in excavations, and it's through their design and classification that experts can deduce the period and nature of exchange more closely. The cosmopolitan and diverse nature of the trade is borne out by some of the work done in the field of underwater archaeology. Discovered by local sea sponge divers off the southern coast of Turkey in 1982, the Uluburun shipwreck provides a crystallised moment in time for Bronze Age trade. Over the next 11 years, and some 22,000 separate dives, archaeologists painstakingly extracted its many treasures for analysis. Dated to around the turn of the 13th century BCE, these finds show a flourishing eastern Mediterranean trade network, a century before the Bronze Age collapse. Significant amongst the finds are 10 tons of copper and 1 ton of tin, which precisely fit the 1 to 10 ratio for bronze and would have made 11 tons of the alloy. Also, beads of amber from the Baltic regions and a gold scarab inscribed with the name of Nefertiti, the famed Egyptian queen, show that the goods on board were from a truly international source. Having lain 44 metres deep beneath the sea for the past 3,000 years, many of the perishables have disappeared without a trace, including the wax tablets that perhaps recorded the ship's destination or designation. Even so, the find is an extremely important piece of evidence in understanding commercial activities of the age. Fortunately, we have some fairly substantial written evidence from the period to help build our picture above and beyond the secrets the earth has revealed. We've discussed Mycenaean Linear B script previously, being more concerned with records than prose, and unfortunately is of little use to Bronze Age research. At the opposite end of this corner of the world, the Egyptians very kindly have transcribed their hieroglyphs across almost every blank surface for our perusal. Heavily propagandized, the glyphs of contemporary pharaohs shed light on the goings-on of the period. They also provide the only real accounts of the mysterious sea peoples. When your ruler is basically the embodiment of the sun, it's reasonably hard to get an unbiased appraisal of events from Egyptian records. Luckily, the countries and peoples of the region engaged in more than just the exchange of goods. They also had a strong level of verbal discourse, recorded and transmitted in what can only be described as the lingua franca of the time, Akkadian. This ancient, Sibyllic script, which used cuneiform in its production, seems to have been the language of international diplomacy in the late Bronze Age. Originally written by pressing a wedge-shaped stylus into wet clay, the tablet was then fired in a kiln for transportation and dissemination. Whole caches of these fired tablets have been discovered via archaeology, and they provide a wealth of knowledge about the dynamic cultures of the era. Coming from different ancient population centres, there is a truly dizzying amount of written evidence for so remote a time. It will be a great help as I try to stitch the voice of these ancients to their archaeological remains. Let's turn now to the mighty Hittite Empire. Mentioned heavily in the biblical Old Testament, their land stretched across most of modern-day Turkey and down through Syria and into Lebanon. At this southernmost extent, they came into contact with the Canaanites of the Levant and an expanding Egyptian empire from northern Africa. To the west, the Hittites, according to the documentary evidence, exerted nominal hegemony over the coastal cities of the Aegean, Troy included. Ruling from the capital city of Hattusa, situated smack bang in the middle of Anatolia, the empire flourished from around 1600 to just into the 12th century BCE. The city itself covered an area of around 1.8 square kilometres and at its height was home to around 50,000 souls. A thriving metropolis with tight bonds of trade and marriage to its regional neighbours. Thanks to excavations of Hattusa, we have a veritable treasure trove of inscriptive evidence from the Empire of the Hatti, as they called themselves. Some 14,000 cuneiform tablets have been excavated from the Hittite capital, and they, among other things, lay out for researchers the interactions of the empire's kings with the surrounding empires. Most relevant to this podcast is a document known as the Tawagalawa Letter, written by a Hittite king to the ruler of a land to the west called Ahiawa. This word has scintillated etymologists and historians alike, due to its similarity to Homer's most common title for the Mycenaeans, the Achaeans. Even more tantalising is the letter referencing an incident around the city of Willusa, which cognately aligns with the Greek word for Troy, Ilios or Ilion. Further adding weight to a possible Trojan War connection is the mention of a shared enemy of the Hittite and Achaean empires, called Pia Maradu. Although this shared enemy's activities took place far from Troy, it's a name linked closely by some scholars with that of King Priam. The Tawagalawa letter dates to around 1250 BCE, which certainly puts it in the right place for the general consensus of the Trojan War. In 1274 BCE, the Egyptian pharaoh Ramesses the Great was marching his armies north along the Levantine coastline looking to secure lands once ruled by his forefathers. Outside a place called Kadesh, located on the modern border of Syria and Lebanon, his forces ran into an army led by the Hittite king Mulwali. The confrontation that ensued was to be the largest chariot battle ever fought, with roughly 6,000 of the horse-drawn weapons of war taking part. The combined forces, numbering some 100,000 men, slogged it out on this ancient battlefield in a very close-run event. Ramesses, despite being misled by bad intelligence, managed to snatch a draw from the jaws of defeat. 16 years later, the two mighty empires signed a lasting peace treaty. Having already discovered the Egyptian version of events inscribed on the walls of the mortuary temple to Ramesses, excavators were amazed to find the Hittite counterpart on a cuneiform tablet within the site of Hattusa. Both sides of the story correspond, and we have the earliest example of a formal peace treaty between two empires with both signatories. This period marked a high point for the Hittites. Within 100 years, their capital city would be sacked for a second time and abandoned, their empire shattered, never to rise again. How did such a large and seemingly powerful nation crumble so soon and with such finality? As we'll see time and again, there were many factors at play here. By 1200 BCE, the people of Hatti were sorely pressed from all sides from external threats and riven from within by a period of civil war. In the decades before, the mysterious sea people were making their way along the western coast of Anatolia, leaving destruction in their wake. Of note in this theatre was the destruction of a nominally Mycenaean city called Miletus, and a little place you may have heard of, Troy. From the north and east, a non-Indo-European group of people known as the Casca were making inroads into the Hittite Empire. They had possibly sacked Hattusa in the early part of the 13th century BCE, forcing the ruling elite to relocate the capital to the southern city of Tahontasa. King Hattusili III seems to have pushed them back, strengthened the borders, and reoccupied Hattusa in around the middle part of that century. The Casca would remain a constant threat down to the end of the Hittite Empire. Also, from the east, an expanding Middle Assyrian Empire provided further pressure for an already strained nation. Situated in modern-day Iraq, by around 1300 BCE, these aggressive and expansive peoples had subjugated and vassalized the Mitanni Kingdom, which lay to the west and formed the eastern buffer state of the Hittites. The people of the Hatti had in past fought with the Mitanni and annexed some of their territory. Thus weakened, the Mitanni became easy pickings for an Assyrian empire flexing its muscles. The second half of the 13th century, in particular, saw the Assyrians make many inroads into Hittite territory and in all likelihood contributed to a disruption in eastern Mediterranean trade, potentially blocking or hampering the transport of tin from the Afghanistan mountain deposits. Finally, for external threats at least, the island of Cyprus to the south of Anatolia became a thorn in the side of the empire, so much so that in around 1210 BCE, a series of naval engagements were fought for control of the island. Whether or not these battles resulted in Hittite control over Cyprus is a matter for debate, and there is a strong possibility that the last king of the Hatti, Sapilu Liuma II, was merely fighting off incursions by the sea people. There is evidence of a distinctly Aegean-styled migration of Cyprus around that time, which lends credence to a possible sea people involvement in that area. As if these pressures on the state weren't enough, recent research has indicated that the greater region in general was suffering from lower temperatures, drought-like conditions, and a scarcity of the food supply. In one study, researchers proved from seabed core sampling that the Mediterranean Sea's temperatures dropped dramatically in the years between the 13th and 11th centuries BCE. Creating less precipitation and less rainfall, the findings are supported by another study which took core samples from beneath the Sea of Galilee and looked at the pollen trapped in the cores. Don't ask me how. I don't know how this stuff works, but the evidence pointed to there being far less pollen and therefore far less plant life during the period. These two studies put together support each other in their findings that during the Late Bronze Age collapse, there was significantly less rainfall and therefore less plant life. That a persistent and dire famine afflicted the Hittite Empire is obvious by some of the correspondence that has come down to us. One of the cuneiform tablets records a letter sent by a Hittite queen in around the year 1250 BCE, informing Pharaoh Ramesses II that there is no grain in my lands. A king from the important Levantine city of Ugarit received multiple communications over the years from the Hittites requesting shipments of grain. The terse and often dramatic requests demonstrate the severity of the scarcity in the lands of the Hatti. One such missive ending with the line, "It is a matter of life and death." It was indeed, and even the final years of the empire saw its last king, Sapilu-Liuma, still requesting outside supplies of grain and even going so far as to chastise other rulers for their procrastination. There are also fragmentary recordings of this last king requesting military aid from Ugarit to assist with enemies who are advancing against the nation. This is the sun setting on the Hittite Empire, surrounded by enemies and sorely pressed on all sides. Its international trade network disrupted by the Assyrians to the east and the sea peoples from the west and south. Famine has further added to the internal destabilization caused by the loss of trade, and no doubt rebellion was beginning to foment against the central authorities. Most experts suggest that the year 1178 BCE, or thereabouts, was when Hattusa was sacked and destroyed, most probably by the Kaska people. The city itself was uninhabited for nearly 400 years afterwards, and a nation that had dominated Anatolia for the better part of half a millennium ceased to exist. Not all of the other Hittite cities experienced similar destruction. For the most part, they are simply abandoned. This is to be expected, and is a common occurrence when central governments are torn down and the systems they prop up fall into disuse. Next, we'll skip over the Aegean to the island of Cyprus. As a stopping point for any east-west and north-south trade, the island clearly occupied an important place in the Eastern Med. In Greek, it has been called Kypros, recorded as such from around the 15th century BCE in Mycenaean Linear B script. It's believed that the island's name, in fact, gives us our word for copper, as Cyprus was the premier source for that metal in the ancient world. Although tiny in comparison to some of its neighbours, the island looks to have enjoyed nominal independence, for the most part due to its supplies of copper. Making up 90% of the materials required to make the bronze, which was so important to the conspicuous consumption of the palace economies, a free Cyprus was in everyone's best interest. Its virtual monopoly of the resource ensured it was a very rich and influential place. Indeed, in the Ugarit text, the feeling is that the island nation's king occupied a place of respect amongst the international community. Also in the case of Ugarit, Cyprus was in a position of hierarchical superiority. Telling too is the omission of Cyprus from the role of Hittite allies listed in the Treaty of Kadesh. They were clearly independent of their larger neighbours. In the Egyptian Amarna letters, there are multiple instances of correspondence between the King of Cyprus and Pharaoh. Telling in these letters is the inference that the two are brothers, which in the diplomatic speak of the time denoted partners of equal worth. This comes at the height of the Egyptian New Kingdom's power when claiming equality with that country was no small boast. In one letter we are given some scope for how powerful and resourceful the island was. Its king informs Pharaoh that he is sending 500 talents of copper, roughly 13 tons, as a welcome gift, and to not be too concerned with how small the amount is. Towards the end of the same letter, the Cyprian king even mildly reprimands Pharaoh for not being more forthcoming with payment on a shipment of timber sent to Egypt. Of course, the king pretends that he isn't worried, but his courtiers are making noise over the issue. Quoting from the letter, "Moreover, my brother, men of my country keep speaking with me about my timber that the king of Egypt receives. My brother, give me the payment that is due." Unlike other Eastern Mediterranean nations, Cyprus doesn't seem to have experienced a complete collapse of society. From 1225 BCE through to around 1180, there seems to have been a period of upheaval, destruction, and resettlement on different parts of the island. The theories as to who perpetrated these troubles and why are many and varied, but as with the Hittites, it's safe to assume that there was a conglomerate of troubles besetting the Cyprians at this time. As we've seen previously, the Hittite Emperor fought a series of battles against the island, ostensibly to enforce hegemony over the people. It's just as likely that these were attacks of opportunity or pacification. Decentralisation due to trade disruption may have lowered the protection forwarded by Cyprus's abundance of copper, and roving sea peoples using the island as a base of operations might also account for Hittite aggression. Either way, on the other side of this 50-odd year period of strife, the Cyprus that arose on the other side bucked the trend of late Bronze Age civilizations and apparently flourished. In the late 1800s of our era, several papyri came to light in an illicit excavation at Al-Hibba in Egypt. One of the documents recovered is known as the story of Wenamun, and is extremely relevant to our opinions of a thriving and prosperous Cyprus post-Bronze Age collapse. Widely considered a historical document for many years, it has since the 1980s come under scrutiny by Egyptologists who believe it a work of historical fiction. It could even be a later embellishment of a historical event, but either which way, the document gives us an insight into the land of Alicia, as Cyprus was known to the Egyptians during the 11th century. The story starts off with the protagonist Wenamun, a priest of Amun serving at Karnak, who was sent by his high priest on a mission to acquire cedar wood. Suffice to say, our hero gets blown off course, and after several other mishaps, winds up on a Cyprian shore. The locals greet him with violence, but Wenamun manages to force his way through to the town princess. He tells her that in his homeland, it is said that the people of Alicia only ever do the right thing by strangers, but that appeared to not be the case currently. Seemingly mollified, the princess offered the priest safe harbour. Dating to 1075 BCE, in the story we can see that Cyprus, over a century after the regional Bronze Age collapse, was not only a place still ruled by an elite caste, but that its inhabitants were renowned for their hospitality. It seems as though there was a gradual hybridisation of indigenous culture with Mycenaean on Cyprus, as by the time of Homer, the island had a distinctly Greek tradition. How and when this melding took place isn't clearly discerned. Certainly, there is much in the way of Mycenaean wares found in the archaeological record, but the same can be said of many of the other countries in the Eastern Med. If it was indeed that the Mycenaeans were merely a part of a larger force of wandering sea peoples, as we'll see moving forward, Cyprus wasn't to be their final stop. Perhaps, though, some did settle in areas vacated by the denudation of population, war, and famine cause. To the east, on the coast of modern Syria, lies an extremely important part to our understanding of the period. Moreover, if Cyprus was a confluence for marine trade in the region, the city of Ugarit served the same purpose for overland trade to the powerful Babylonian kingdoms in modern-day Iran. More city-state than empire, Ugarit exerted control over only the towns and villages in its immediate vicinity. As it was situated within the traditional zones of contention between the Hittite and Egyptian empires, it functioned under a free form of vassalage. At the time of the Bronze Age collapse, the Hittite Empire extended its hegemony over the city and its surrounds, having wrested it most probably from the Egyptians in around 1350 BCE. The hand of oppression was clearly a light one, a fact borne out by the gift of cuneiform inscribed tablets found in the ruins of the city. The archives, discovered first in 1929, are rich with not only the correspondence from neighbouring kingdoms, but they also have a collection of epic poems, legal documents, and international treaties, among other things. All in all, the several thousand clay tablets describe not only a colourful and thriving civilization, but one succinctly aware of its inheritance and legacy. As a whole, the collection is worthy of its own episode, or series for that matter, as in my opinion it's a highly undervalued piece of history. But that's not this show. For us, what is highly relevant are the missives sent to and from Ugarit at an apparent time of external strife. The city itself is believed to have been destroyed around 1190 BCE, so it's safe to assume these communications date, obviously, to around this time. One addressed from the king of Carchemish, an inland city to the north, to the city elders of Ugarit. In it, the king exhorts the Ugarit people to hold out and that they are on their way with reinforcements to help the city. Whether or not this relief force made it and were of any difference in the conflict is hard to say, but another letter seems to indicate that they were too late. Quoting directly from the private letter, the scribe seems to almost posthumously bemoan Ugarit's fate. When your messenger arrived, the army was humiliated and the city was sacked. Our food in the threshing floors was burnt and the vineyards were also destroyed. Our city is sacked. May you know it. May you know it. This apparent destruction by fire was noticed by the excavators at the site, who described ashen layers as thick as 2 meters in some parts. Buried personal treasure was also discovered in different locations, indicating a populace that was running to the hills, so to speak, but had every intention of returning. They never did, and for over 6 centuries the site remained vacated. In another communication, this time from the last king of Ugarit, Amurapi, addressed to the king of Alisia. Quoting from it, we see a king beseeching aid for his people. My father, behold, the enemy ships came here. My cities were burned, and they did evil things in my country. Does not my father know that all of my troops and chariots are in the land of the Hatti, and all my ships are in the land of the Luka? Thus, the country is abandoned to itself. May my father know it. The 7 ships of the enemy came here, inflicted much damage upon us. Once again, it's difficult to tell which period this letter comes from, and as we'll see when we look at the Egyptian Empire, if indeed it was sea people, that their migrations or predations happened over an extended period of time. The line, they did evil things, is also very poignant, denoting an unknown or conglomerate force of adversaries. Couple that with the idea of the enemy being shipbound, it's almost begging for a sea people connection. Another thing of interest in this letter are the words, my father, pointing out the subservient nature of the relationship between Ugarit and Cyprus, and the reference to all troops being with the Hatti. As we've learned, the Hatti are the Hittite people, and their hegemony extended over Ugarit at this time. Had the last Hittite king, Sapilu-Liuma II, requested all vassalized forces to support him in his wars against foreign invaders? We'll never know the answer fully, but the story this letter describes is tantalizing. Whatever the case, the archaeological and textual evidence from the city clearly indicates its destruction at the end of the Bronze Age, another domino fallen. Before we leave the Levantine coast and move on to the Egyptian superpower of the south, I'd like to say a few things relating to the culture known as Canaanite living in the area of modern Israel. These people are largely believed to be indigenous to the area, and for most of the time we are concerned with, were ruled by an Egyptian pharaoh. The destruction in the region at the time of the Late Bronze Age coincides with 2 events of significance: the rise of the Philistine Pentapolis, and the rise or return of the Israelites, both mentioned in the Old Testament. The Pentapolis, coming from the Greek for 5 cities, represented a coalition of 5 Philistine city-states that combined politically at some stage during the early 12th century BCE, where they displaced the older Canaanite societies and certainly hybridized with them to a degree. The Philistines are the modern-day Palestinians, who still live in the region today, albeit in abject statelessness. Of note, the term Philistine is cognately linked with another name for the Sea Peoples, inscribed in Egypt, that of the Palisade people. Moreover, there are even scholars who think it links with a term used historically for indigenous Aegean or Greek peoples, the Pelasgians. The archaeological record for the period in the region is fairly telling in that it shows the supplantation of the previous Canaanite culture with one that had a distinctly Aegean feel. Could this place be one of the final resting places of the Sea People migrations? We'll see. For the Israelites, it's a very difficult thing to describe with any degree of accuracy, for me at least. I think you have to separate the Israelites of history from those of the Bible. There is no firm, non-religious, textual evidence to support the exodus of the Jews from Egypt. Most of academia believes that they formed a mostly indigenous tribe of the greater Canaanite peoples. Like the Romans, who were simply one tribe of the Latins and then rose to prominence and dominance, so too it was for the Israelites. Long before Yahweh became the God of the Trinity, and before even monotheism, Yahweh was just one among many of the gods the Israelites revered alongside their Canaanite brothers. Today's Hebrew is just a 3,000-year distillation of the archaic language spoken by the Jews and Canaanites in the Late Bronze Age. The first historical mention of the Israelites comes from an Egyptian inscription dating to 1209 BCE during the reign of Pharaoh Merneptah. It mentions 2 things of interest. Firstly, that the land of Canaan had been plundered with every evil, and more specifically that Israel lies fallow, it has no seed. This inscription furthers the evidence of destruction and famine in the period we are concerned with. In the Bible, the text only ever refers to the Egyptian king by his title, Pharaoh, and never by name. This has led to multiple theories over who was the ruler that presided over the mass exodus of the Israelites, led by Moses into the desert and out of bondage. Popularly, Ramesses II has been imagined the culprit by movie directors and authors alike. Having ruled a whopping 66 years from 1279 to 1213 BCE, he would have ruled longer had they had good dentists back in Egypt, most likely dying of a tooth infection at age 90. Say that Exodus occurred sometime during the later stages of his reign. Canaan via a 40-year detour in the desert fits the Bronze Age timeline very nicely indeed. The Egyptians had a proclivity for scribing their hieroglyphs on any surface they could. In nowhere, in any way, is there a record of an entire people slipping their chains and fleeing to the Promised Land. But then again, they also had a predisposition towards self-aggrandizement and in all likelihood would hardly record such a thing for posterity's disdain. It's entirely possible that merely a portion of the tribe were in servitude, and the Bible mentions that it was Jacob and his sons that went to Egypt. Perhaps the rest stayed in Canaan. Either way, the important thing is that during the late Bronze Age collapse, Israelite activity increased in the Levant at the close of the 13th century BCE. Lastly, for the eastern end of the Mediterranean, there is a final bit of sea people evidence to describe. The ruins of Dor are located on the coast of modern Israel, 60 kilometres north of the Gaza Strip. It has the distinction of being ruled by possible descendants of the sea peoples as recorded in the story of Wenamun that we looked at previously. The priest of Amun, as part of his earlier misadventures, has several run-ins with the Jekka people who are listed as having ruled Dor within the text. The Jekka, too, are numbered as part of the sea peoples. Remembering the Wenamun affair occurred in the 11th century, some 100 years after the Bronze Age collapse, it's possible that Dor became the destination for at least that part of the greater migration. For further indication, let's move over to the mighty Pharaonic Empire of Egypt. Now, I've got a little personal penchant for Egyptology and even toyed with the idea of doing a podcast about the Egyptians. My understanding of Greek and having lived in Greece went out in the end, but it was a close-run thing. An ancient and venerable empire that for 3,000 years and for 31 dynasties dominated the land on either side of the Nile River and its lower basin. The architecture and hieroglyphic record of the Egyptians have left an indelible impression upon the imaginations of expert and amateur alike, and their relics form a sizable chunk of most prestigious museum collections. By the time their history winds up in our scope of focus, the largest of the pyramids had stood in dominance of the Giza Plateau for some 1,400 years already. The Late Bronze Age falls under what is called the New Kingdom period, specifically during the 19th and into the 20th dynasties. The period would see a revitalization of Egyptian fortunes and the empire reach its greatest extent under Pharaoh Thutmose III in the 15th century BCE. That ruler's great-grandson, Amenhotep III, presided over the peak of Egyptian cultural and artistic practices. Several rulers in a dynasty change later, Ramesses the Great and his monumental 66-year reign would solidify Egypt's place as the big player in the Eastern Mediterranean for over 300 years. There was a storm brewing on the horizon of that great pharaoh's reign, and within 40 years of his death, Egypt would begin to experience so bitter a reversal of fortune that she would never reattain her past glories. Living as a pale shadow of its former might, the empire would limp along with the odd fit and start for the next millennium, when, as a decrepit and docile entity, it would be absorbed into first the Persian, then the Macedonian, and finally the burgeoning Roman Empire. The gloss really started to rub off with the death of old Ramesses, though perhaps the decay had set in due to the cost of so ambitious and militaristic pharaoh. Dying in the year 1213 BCE, it would be the last great rule by an Egyptian pharaoh. Ramesses was some kind of real-life King Priam, having somewhere in the vicinity of 50 sons and 50 daughters over his extended life. His 13th son, Meneptah, succeeded his father to the double crown of Upper and Lower Egypt. This pharaoh's reign would be the first from which we have concrete evidence of sea people aggressions in the form of what is called the Great Karnak Inscription. Found on pylons of the Karnak Temple complex in Luxor, it remains the longest continuous monumental text to survive from ancient Egypt. Its contents describe Meneptah rallying his forces to meet an invasion off the Western Nile Delta region by the neighbouring Libyan kingdom. Tensions between Libya and Egypt were nothing new to the region. What was different this time is the invaders had some very interesting allies, the sea people. Along with all the usual propaganda, rousing speeches, godlike investment of power and general pharaonic kick-assness, the Karnak inscription lays out in often lurid detail the Egyptians' victory over the invaders. I'll work through the inscription now, quoting from the relevant parts and analyse the information as we go to tease out the relevance. The first section we have only in a reconstructed form, the top part of the text being destroyed and illegible. Most likely, beginning with a list of the enemies and their transgressions, which is the general way most other inscriptions begin, a formula, if you will, Indeed, the first glyphs visible say that the king of Libya and the Akawasha, the Terosha, the Luka, Sherdan, and Shekelesh, the northerners who came from all lands. Although fragmentary, the Sea Peoples seemingly burst onto the historical record at this point. Differentiated from the Libyans by being referred to as northerners, the directional designation does little to help us locate these mysterious names' origin. From Egypt, putting Libya and the Sinai aside, everything is north, and these northerners came from all lands. It also tells us that the scribe isn't talking about different tribe names of the one people, but different nations from all over, joined together in war. Those names have tortured entomologists since their translation, and some bear a striking resemblance to other, more familiar names. Akawasha, Achaeans, Sherdan, Sardinia, Shekelesh, Sicily. The only one of the five that is remotely reliable is for the Luka, who have been tied to the ancient region of Lycia in southwestern Turkey. Before moving on, it should be noted that evidence for Sicilian and Sardinian participation in Sea People migrations and settlement is almost non-existent, regardless of possible etymological links. The next few lines describe Egypt as a land in turmoil, experience a breakdown of law and order, suffering under the raids of most likely Sea People. Metaphor, allegory, or fact, it's hard to discern, and much in this section is open to interpretation. Lines like, "It was stormy in the vicinity of the ancestors, with the result that all the kings sat in their pyramids." Poetic in form, but placed against another line. "Egypt was as that which was not defended. It was abandoned as pasture for cattle." You get the sense of a dynastic struggle, leading to a weakening of centralized government and external defences, allowing for the predation of wandering armies. And it just makes plain old sense, too. The time was merely 5 years from the godfather of Egyptian pharaohs departing for his chat with Anubis, leaving more heirs than you can shake a hecker at, those funny crook things you see pharaohs carrying. Out of Ramesses' 50 or so sons, some had died through the natural attrition of time, disease, and misfortune due to the old man's longevity. But his passing left perhaps 30 sons, all with their own motives and power bases to contend over the throne. The Karnak inscription describes an Egypt beset from the outside, but broiling with internal strife. Merneptah rises to be the successful candidate, managing through ways not recorded to unite the two crowns in defence of the homeland. His reign, traditionally backdated to Ramses the Great's death, perhaps began closer to the 5th year, after when the Libyans and their allies invaded. Next of relevance are lines 13, 14, and 15, which once again assert the enemies of Merneptah as the Libyans and the Sea Peoples. However, this time the listing of foes finishes with a little vignette when it says of the tribes, "consisting of the best of every fighter and every runner of his foreign land, he bringing his wife and children." Just as the Kimbri tribe, when they had entered Roman territory to meet Gaius Marius in 101 BCE, the disparate tribes were part of a larger societal migration. It was a high-stakes game with settlement as the reward and the erasure of your people at the price of failure. Save possibly the Luka, who I'll go into more later, who had a history of mercenary attitudes, I would suggest that for various reasons, a vast number of the invasion force were fleeing their ancestral lands. Eventually, after several oaths and divine visions, the pharaoh assembles his forces to meet the foreigners in battle. The two sides clashed on April the 15th, 1207 BCE, in the Western Nile Delta. A drawn-out affair, the Karnak inscription records the contest lasting for 6 hours whilst the pharaoh's archers rained death incessantly upon the enemy. At what is clearly a pivotal point in the battle, the Libyan king abandons his troops and flees the scene. From the inscription, "The wretched king of Libya was terrified, his heart weak. He left his sandals, his bow, his quiver in haste behind him." Merneptah's chariots run down some of the retreating foe before the chase is called off. Recorded for the pharaoh's glory and our intrigue is a list of all of the prisoners and plunder recovered from the enemy. The Libyan dead were visited with the punishment of mutilation, having their penises chopped off, with the particular attention paid to whether they were circumcised or not. In case you were wondering, the inscription says that there were 6 with foreskins and 6,359 without. Ouch. Amongst the Libyan prisoners, there were 12 of the king's wives, whose husband had abandoned them. The Sea People corpses too were mutilated in a fashion similar, and some of the survivors had their hands removed. The list states 1,140 hands collected. The total number of captives is stated as 9,376, with 9,111 swords and 120,214 arrows. This was a large, well-prepared force, but it was also incredibly well-supplied, with 1,307 cattle becoming Egyptian property. Unfortunately, the list disappears into lacuna at this point. Silver drinking vessels, razors, and etc., giving the whole exercise a migratory feel. The inscription finishes with all due praise to the gods and Meneptah for the deliverance of the Egyptian people. The male prisoners, who were most probably eunuchs by that stage, were installed at military garrisons in the delta and forced to defend those who they once sought to destroy or supplant. As for the women and children, it would more than likely be their fate to live in bondage and service to their new masters. The overall picture is one of complete victory for the locals, but the mere fact that this war was fought in the heartlands and not on the frontier speaks to a weakening of Egyptian defences. Before we leave Luxor and Meneptah's inscription, there is another record of note in the same temple. It tells of a famine in the Hittites' lands and how, through the help of a go-between, the pharaoh had been supplying the people of the Hatti with grain. Meneptah is clearly angry with his counterpart, who he calls, and I quote, "Their king is like a dog, a man of boasting without courage." It seems that the Libyan and Sea People's force destroyed the fleet of this go-between, who was transporting the grain. That the Egyptian blames the Hittites implies that at least some of the Sea People were from that region of Anatolia. Otherwise, the mistaken identity is hard to reason. At the very least, it is more fuel on the fire to the troubles that were besetting the Eastern Mediterranean in those times. And for the moment, things return to relative normality in the lands of Egypt, and the Sea Peoples fade from recorded history. 30 years later, they returned with a vengeance. They also decided to bring some friends this time as well. The year was 1177 BCE, and it would be Pharaoh Ramesses III, the last new kingdom ruler of note, upon whom it was incumbent to halt the invasion. Fortunately for him, and for us, he won, and in true Egyptian fashion, he left an inscription on his mortuary temple in order to promote his glory into perpetuity. Better still, we get pictures of this awesomeness too. I'll put the photos up on the website, but the carvers left an amazing design of the pharaoh and his forces in action for our amazement. In fact, Ramesses spent basically his entire tenure at war, and his temple at Medinet Habu is covered with brilliant works of art and hieroglyphic prose relating to his campaigns. Ramesses and his troops defeated the invaders in two separate battles. The first occurred in the region of Jahi, believed to be in modern-day Israel, and was fought as a land battle. The relief of this battle shows a larger-than-life Ramesses raining arrows upon the enemy from the back of his chariot. The second conflict seemingly takes place at an outlet of the Nile Delta, and it appears the Egyptian army has ambushed the Sea Peoples. Emerging from reed-covered banks, the defenders launch grappling hooks to trap the invaders' ships, haul them to shore, and slaughter the occupants. The relief for the contest has some truly amazing detail, even going so far as to show a sea person drowning, struggling to reach the surface of the Nile. Big Ramesses is back this time too, but he has condescended to dismount from his chariot and shoots the enemy from a standing position. The central inscription deals with the constituents of the invading force with a sonic brevity, so I'll read the first passage in full. "The foreign countries made a conspiracy in their islands. All at once the lands were removed and scattered into the fray. No land could stand before their arms, from Hatti, Carchemish, Azawa, and Alishia, all being cut off at one time. A camp was set up in the lands of Amaru. They desolated its people, and its land was like that which has never come into being. They were coming forward toward Egypt, while the flame was prepared before them. Their confederation was the Pelasset, the Cheka, the Shekelesh, the Danuna, and the Weshesh, all lands united. They laid their hands upon the lands as far as the circuit of the earth, their hearts confident and trusting. Our plans will succeed." It's heady stuff. Remembering the year 1177 BCE, by this time Egypt is the only major power in the region that has not succumbed to one of the many blights on offer for the times. We've seen already that the Hatti, the Hittites, had ceased to function as a state as little as a year before. Carchemish was the city that sent aid to Ugarit, but arrived too late and also suffered destruction around the same time. Azawa is an area in southwestern Anatolia, and out of the cities listed, most probably experienced destruction and privation first. As we've seen, Alisia is Cyprus, and being an island, was exposed to lengthy and protracted disturbances. The Amorite people, whom are referred to here as the Amaru, certainly disappear from recorded and archaeological history around the 1200 BCE mark, making the line, "They desolated its people, and its land was like that which has never come into being. Right on the money. For the invaders, the Shekelesh have returned once more, with four new additions to the list of sea peoples. The Palaset have been almost universally identified as the Philistines of biblical fame, as I discussed before. Their most likely point of origin is somewhere in the Aegean. The Jekka, we met earlier in the Egyptian report on Wenumen, and were by that time, 1100 BCE, settled in the Canaan. Their origins are obscure, but some people believe they, like the Shekelesh, come from Sicily. The Danuna, for my money and for a lot of others, are linked with the Danaans, another name for Homer's Mycenaeans. Lastly, the Weshesh, we know, or can guess, at almost nothing. They were even recorded as the shadowy ones. Looks like they were relatively unknown to the Egyptians as well. One and all, they were defeated, and as in Meneptah's reign, the prisoners were similarly mutilated and settled in Egyptian strongholds. Many, it seems, were found new homes in the land of Canaan, which was at this time still nominally under pharaonic control. I'll let Rameses tell the complete nature of his victory from the inscription. Those who reach my frontier, their seed is not, their heart and soul are finished forever and ever. Those who came forward together on the sea, the full flame was in front of them at the river mouths, while a stockade of lances surrounded them on the shore. They were dragged in, enclosed, and prostrated on the beach, killed and made into heaps from tail to head. It would be the last time the sea peoples are recorded as making war on Egypt, or for that matter anyone. There was really no one else to war against by this time, and the Bronze Age collapse was entering its final stages. Although Rameses ruled for another 20 years, the economic cost of the wars and the failure of trade networks, coupled with other environmental factors, would prove too much for his ailing empire. Another 20 years, and Egyptian possessions in the Levant are lost, and as I mentioned earlier, it would continue to dwindle in prosperity from there. Unlike the Hittites, who arguably had an equivalence of power, Egypt managed to avoid complete and utter systems collapse at the end of the Bronze Age. Moreover, it staved off two separate, mass incursions of warriors and migrants and lived to tell a tale. What was their secret? As with the reasons for the Bronze Age collapse, the reason for Egypt's survival is multifaceted, but I believe there are two main contributors: food supply. We've discussed possible climate change factors affecting rainfall in the Mediterranean and the crop failures a protracted drought can cause. There's evidence in the remaining archives for food shortages in the Hittite Empire and elsewhere over a prolonged period. The Kingdom of the Nile didn't rely on coastal rains or weather systems for the bulk of its water, having bolted its civilization onto the concourse of the mighty river. The Egyptians were well versed in the ebb and flow of this mighty stream and could predict with some accuracy the degree to which its yearly flood occurred. Annually, when the river bursts its banks, it washes nutritious alluvial soil across the bordering plains. Planting their crops in such rich soil provided the Egyptians with an abundance rarely seen in the ancient world. It was this predictable, regular supply of grain that was the main cause not just behind Egypt's avoidance of complete collapse, but the reason their empire lasted for the better part of 3 millennia. With its incorporation into the Roman Empire, it became the capital's chief supplier of grain to the masses. But as we'll discuss later, such food independence was a double-edged sword, and surely the envy of crumbling empires and lawless refugees. The Nile wasn't just the lifeblood of the pharaohs chosen, it was also a source of great wealth. Quite literally a river of gold, early Egyptians learned to sift the gold substance from its sandy bottom. They supplemented this with Nubian mined gold from the south and had a significant output. Once again, there is a lot of correspondence from external rulers requesting shipments of gold from Egypt, where it's remarked that the gold is as dust in that land. A 14th century Amarna letter from the king of Mitanni to Pharaoh says, "I also asked my brother for much gold, saying, may my brother grant me more than he did my father. May my brother treat me 10 times better than he did my father." Together with a stable food supply, this resource made Egypt a powerhouse. So much so that in the Imperial Roman era, it was always governed personally, though in absentia, by the emperor. Egypt was so potent that a contender could build a rival empire around its bounty. These two factors were enough to stave off destruction, but without a functioning Bronze Age Eastern Mediterranean economy with which to participate, Egypt faded into relative obscurity. To review the symptoms of the collapse, we've looked to the north and understood the decline and failure of the powerful Hittite Empire. Pressed on all sides, it eventually disintegrated to the degree that until their rediscovery, they were merely a mythical people mentioned in the Bible. The Cypriots dealt with an extended period of upheaval, and whilst not disappearing, they experienced dire straits. A massive shift in the island's culture is obvious by its distinct Greekness when it comes back onto the scene post-Dark Age. A good portion of the many city-states and small kingdoms in the Levant have been razed to the ground and abandoned, coupled with the beginning of apparent Philistine and Israelite increased presence in the area. Egypt has been well described. Hopefully the causes of this climatic end to the Bronze Age are starting to become apparent. There's climate change and the lengthy persistent droughts. Crop and livestock failure follow, and if the problem isn't a localized one, the severity of the famine can be far worse as nations need to go to greater and greater lengths to feed their populace. The disruption such internal distress causes to empires strains them to breaking point. Throw in an endless morass of displaced peoples washing up on the shores of distressed empires, something that Europe has had to manage in recent times with the refugee crisis. Our much-vaunted democracies 3,000 years on are struggling to cope with these. Internal rebellion and external invasion. A cycle begins to develop. Maybe a few earthquakes to top it all off. It's a recipe for disaster. And that storm on the horizon was perhaps the perfect storm. The only piece of the puzzle remaining is the Mycenaeans. How did they fare during the Late Bronze Age, and what was their contribution to its collapse? It's a complex story, and I need to establish the world they were part of, as I think the fate of these early Greeks is intrinsically linked to that of the Sea Peoples. They are the much maligned phantoms of the Bronze Age, turning up here and there, leaving little trace but accruing almost universal blame. So, next time I'll be closing out the epoch with a description of the Mycenaean people's final days, the mass denuding of populations, and explanations of possible emigrations. I can't wait, and I'm really looking forward to completely laying out my hypothesis for you. Please join me on Sunday the 2nd of August for episode 11, The End of an Age. Until then, dear listeners, take good care and speak soon. I certainly don't mean to make light of a mass movement of Israelites travelling through the desert, but the word Exodus is an interesting one. Literally meaning in Greek, the road out, it has become synonymous with a mass exit of people. In Greece today, the word Exodos is signed on every door leading outside from public venues, serving the same purpose as our exit signs. It's always made walking outside feel extremely dramatic for me in Greece. Please check out my website, spartanhistorypodcast.com, where I have extra information, photos and maps of the areas discussed. You can find me on Twitter at Spartan_history and on Facebook too at Spartan History Podcast. If you like this episode and are keen to hear more, subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you catch your pods from and leave a review. See you next time.